Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:07 PM, the Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 12th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I do think that we're in a period of change in the stock market and global markets generally. And certainly when we look at Bitcoin, it's been doing spectacularly well this year and over the last 12 months. And that is attracting increasing attention. So there are some people who think that it is well on its way to a six-digit price, and that subsequent to that, it might even go to seven digits. And then, of course, we have other people who think it's a tulip mania and that it's completely worthless and should really be priced at zero. And in between those two extremes, there's probably somewhere where the truth can be found. So let's just, in the first case, think, is there, in fact, a utility for Bitcoin? Well, one answer to that question might be in India's response to Bitcoin. They decided today that they're going to ban all trading in cryptocurrencies. So they're not going to enforce it for the next 6 months. They're going to give people time to get out of their positions. I do wonder, however, how they are going to enforce this rule, and whether that is going to be because they're going to stop people from mining, or they're going to monitor people's electricity usage. I think that's probably a bit too technical for their capabilities at present. But the reality is that there is a singular reason why people are interested in a hard currency that is of limited supply. And we can understand that when we look at, for example, the Indian rupees long-term chart. Because yes, it has been steady over the course of 2020, but there is no denying that the rupee has gone from approximately 40 to the dollar to 70-something to the dollar in the space of the last 13 years. So it's not far off a halving in value over that time. It contrasts sharply with the period of appreciation in the currency between about 2001 and 2007. So we can also think about the fact that Bitcoin didn't come into existence until the financial crisis in 2008. And the reason that it came into existence was because people were worried about the devaluation of currencies. If we go back and look at the history of the tulip mania, it happened in the 1630s. There was a significant period of currency devaluation that had occurred in the 1620s in the Netherlands. It was followed by a period of relative economic prosperity, and then people started putting some additional interest into financialization of the economy. So what in fact occurred during the tulip mania was that they created financial futures and promissory notes for tulip bulbs that were still in the ground. And then there evolved a lot of retail trading around those promissory notes. These types of activities were occurring outside of the exchanges in Amsterdam, and they were often accompanied with a great deal of drinking. So prices tended to really rocket there, but it also followed the time of very weak money, and then people started to put their faith in not only financialization, but also in real assets. And they did think of a tulip bulb as being a real asset because of the consumer demand for pretty flowers. So that at least is a parallel with what we're seeing in terms of retail demand for Bitcoin, the visceral experience of going through the financial crisis, then watching the purchasing power of your currency devaluing. Obviously, this is a much more important factor for people in India than it is in other countries, because they've gone through a very lengthy period of time where they've had to deal with a devaluing currency. There was certainly a period of stability from approximately 2002 through to about 2010 or 11. But prior to that, it had also been through a very lengthy period of devaluation. Well, historically, people in India have prized gold because it does tend to hold its value through these lengthy periods of currency devaluation. And the advocates of Bitcoin will certainly be thinking about that in terms of this being a digital asset that is a lot more portable than Bitcoin is, for example. So, what is the real utility of Bitcoin? Well, at the moment, there isn't one. I think we can all, I think even the most rabid bulls can conclude that it's very hard to make a convincing argument that we need cryptocurrencies today. But perhaps at some point in the future, we will have a real use for them. But until that occurs, then there's going to be this back and forth argument about their utility. The reality is that we're in a global economy and we are in a period of weak money. So there is obviously a clear intention by governments to inflate away their debts, and there have been extraordinary debts taken on over the course of the last year. So Bitcoin is inflating right along with that devaluation of the purchasing power of fiat currencies. And right now, there is nobody doing more to devalue their currency than the USA. So the dollar index was a little bit weak, or excuse me, stronger in here today, but this continues to look like a bear market overall. When we look at this over the long term, and we can go back and look at all of the back history that we have, well, then we're presented with a very cyclical downtrend, that there have been periods of about 6 to 7 years on the upside and the downside, so messing around in between, another 6 to 7 year uptrend, similar downtrend, messing around in between, and then a big uptrend, some messing around, and then potentially now the next move will be to new lows. And that could take another 5 or 6 years. So we're in another period of financial repression. This is not all that different from the period of time that we had in the early 2000s. Now, on that occasion, we had two coinciding factors that contributed to the decline in the dollar index. The first was that the tech bubble had popped, then we had 9/11. The people that were controlling both monetary and fiscal policy in the USA decided that, and in a fearful moment, decided that it was really important to reflate the economy and make sure that everyone has enough of everything. And they lowered lending standards, it created a bubbly environment in the housing market, massive financialization of the economy. And at the other side of the equation, you had the euro had just been introduced, and it did nothing but fall for the first 18 months of its existence. There was multilateral intervention to support the euro. So the euro went up, the dollar went down, and it continued all the way through until the credit crisis in 2008. Well, Europe doesn't want a strong currency right now. So that is a mitigating factor in a similar downtrend to the decline that we had in 2001 through 2009. But there is a point that one of the reasons why the euro has been so weak over the course of this last 8 years has been because of fears that it was about to break up. And that just does not look credible any longer. The cost of leaving the EU is very high. That's particularly true for countries where they have a lot of trade with the rest of the EU. We can see how much difficulty the UK has had with leaving the EU. It's taken years of negotiation. Those negotiations are still contentious. It's required a sacrifice in terms of both losing businesses that had been centered in the UK and accessing the EU. The swaps business in the city of London, for example, has migrated back to the EU. That's always been a bugbear for the Europeans. At the same time, they've had to redraw the border. The border between the UK and Ireland had always been between the 26 southern counties and the six counties in Northern Ireland, and now it's down the middle of the Irish Sea. So that has essentially isolated Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, and the dissolution of the United Kingdom was not something that people thought they were voting for when they voted for Brexit, but it does look like that is a potential outcome. So there is the clear scope that the UK can regroup and come out of this entire episode in a stronger position. But I think it would be naive to think that it's not going to take some sacrifices along the way. Well, in terms of the markets, the investors are at least willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the pound, and it continues to appreciate against the dollar. And it's also reasonably firm against the euro. So we can think about the fact that, yes, there are sacrifices that the UK has had to make, but most of them are in the past, and that the market has already priced them in. Whereas the potential for recovery and the potential for a strong showing are still in the future. And the fact that the UK has been able to address some of its weaknesses, but also then to demonstrate that it can take a leading role in vaccine production and rollout, that at least will give an air of confidence to investors and to UK people that they can in fact approach challenges and come out the other side with a success story. And the UK's success in rolling out vaccines is really quite impressive. And it justifies additional upside for the pound. It's also likely to be really positive for the domestic market. So the FTSE 250 continues to represent the domestic market. It's been consolidating for the last few weeks, but this doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation. The FTSE 100 continues to lag, and not least because it is a much more internationally oriented market. So there is the clear scope that it will be able to push up and out of this range, but it's going to be dependent on the continued recovery of the global economy. And the continued recovery of the global economy looks to be set. And I think there are a couple of different comparisons that really give us a lot of insight. There are some eyebrow-raising headlines that have been doing the rounds over the course of the last couple of months. The first was that Apple was worth more than the entire market cap of the Russell 2000. That's no longer the case. I've seen it quoted in news stories until really quite recently, but it really only occurred for a couple of days in August, where the market cap of Apple exceeded that of the Russell 2000. So when we then think about what that means, well, one company being worth more than 2,000 other companies, and that is an extraordinary fact in its own right. But when we then look at the ratio of the Russell 2000 to the Nasdaq, well, it underperformed in really quite profound fashion all the way through the 1980s and 90s, and then bottomed in 2000, and then we had a really quite significant rebound for small caps, and they outperformed the high growth and big larger cap technologies firms for the next 7 years. And then they went into another chronic period of underperformance relative to large cap tech. But we've seen a really quite significant rebound since that, really since immediately after the Apple market cap exceeded that of the Russell 2000. That kind of event and the kind of headlines that it made were exactly the kind of wake-up call that investors were, I think, probably waiting for, that valuations on large cap tech have gone really quite out of kilter. Just recently then, we've had that Apple, excuse me, that's the Apple chart. Recently we've had, I'm sorry, I've opened the same chart twice. That's not particularly smart. Now we have the Tesla headline. Tesla's market cap exceeded that of the entire S&P 500 energy sector at the beginning of January this year. Now that's a pretty profound condition. Tesla's share price has been doing little but advance, and it's paused over the last couple of weeks, whereas the energy sector's market cap has declined significantly over the course of the pandemic, and it is only in the middle of, or I think perhaps not even just the beginning of, a recovery phase. So rather than thinking about, well, golly, this is a massive change, it's probably more of a wake-up call to investors to highlight the fact that energy stocks are really cheap. So let's then just look at some of those charts. Tesla has accelerated in no uncertain terms. And of course, it also has got connotations with Bitcoin, because Elon Musk has said that Tesla has invested $1.5 billion in Bitcoin. But the reality is that Tesla's share has stopped rising. There was news yesterday that its range has not come in as reported in any of the Edmunds surveys, so that is certainly a factor that could contribute to additional weakness. But the other point, of course, is that it is nearly 50% overextended relative to the trend mean, and it is done spectacularly well recently. When we then think about the energy sector, well, it is at the point of pariah status and is just beginning to recover. So the energy sector is trading at a discount to the oil price. When we look at companies like Chevron, Chevron has been paying a dividend for over 100 years, and it currently yields 5.5%. And 5.5% is an interesting level, because it's competitive versus just about anything. And it is, the share is firming from the region of the trend mean. I'd say when it's competitive relative to just about anything, because when we look at, for example, the high yield sector, then the high yield bond ETF yields about 4%. So by buying Chevron, you're picking up an additional 1% on the equity versus high yield bonds. What I found rather interesting today as well, when looking at frontier markets, I saw that there was a number of bond funds that have income, and I thought, well, they must pay big dividends, but I was wrong. That in fact the indicated yield is still only about 4%. So this is an additional point, that when we think about where energy is sitting versus where bonds are sitting, well, if we're thinking about where there is bubbly activity, that we can look at the frontier markets bond fund and think about, well, what kind of bonds do they hold? So they own Senegal, Angola, Kenya, Nigeria, Barbados, Iraq, Ecuador, and Benin. Now, whatever about the oil income of Iraq, Benin is not exactly the kind of country where I think anyone would think of as deserving only a 5% coupon. Now, when we think about bond yields, well, the reason that bond yields have are that the yield on high yield and the yield on frontier is exactly the same is because bond yields are so low. But what I find interesting is that bond yields are rising, and this is not at all being priced into the risk factors of the high yield sector or even the frontier bond markets. So there is a source of repricing in the bond markets. Bond yields today closed above 1.2%, and stock markets were in positive territory. So this has not resulted in a widespread source of fear. But we have to at least consider that there is a great deal of debt that needs to be paid back, and there's no real plan for how to do that. The only plan is to print the money. And the Federal Reserve is apparently willing to allow bond yields to advance, but that comes with the rider that they're going to have to produce as additional liquidity to fund the spending requirements of the US government. And that's why stock markets remain steady, because they're betting on additional liquidity. When we think about the high yield bond spread, well, it's still really very low. In fact, it made another new low yesterday. So we're coming all the way back down towards the all-time lows put in 2014. And there's no real evidence that this trend is over just yet. Now, as bond yields continue to rise, what investors are basically saying is that there's more risk in the government than there is in high-yield issuers, because the Federal Reserve is willing to buy high-yield bonds, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to ensure that the economy remains in a reasonable condition. So there is at least clear evidence of a one-way bet among investors that the Federal Reserve is going to provide a safety net, and that the safety net is a lot closer than anyone might be willing to consider. And this, I think, is why we've only seen a couple of percent pullback in the S&P at the end of January. And the market has pushed on now to a new high in here today, because investors are willing to bet that we're not going to see much of a pullback before the Federal Reserve will have to act. Now, the U.S. government is going to be at a point where they are going to be issuing more debt than the Federal Reserve is currently buying in the second quarter of this year. Well, today's the 12th of February, so that is only about 6 months, six weeks to 10 weeks away from now. So stock market investors are betting that we're going to get an announcement from the Federal Reserve that they're going to increase the amount of supply of dollars that they are willing to put into the market. That's why the dollar remains weak. It's the clearest reason, rationale, why the dollar remains weak, even against the euro, despite the fact that the Europeans are talking down the currency, because the country right now that is most willing to allow its currency to appreciate is the renminbi. Now, the onshore renminbi doesn't quote during the Chinese New Year, and today is Chinese New Year, so Gongxi Fa Sai to all of our Chinese subscribers. But when we look at the offshore renminbi, then it was in positive territory in here today, and this remains a consistent trend. So China appears willing to allow its currency to appreciate. It is taking the other side of the downtrend in the dollar that the euro took back in the early 2000s. They want to demonstrate that the currency is strong, that they're coming out of the pandemic in a more or in a stronger position than any other country, and that they are also trying to contain inflationary pressures by allowing the currency to appreciate. Of course, they're also attempting to try and curtail a lot of speculation in the domestic market. The last thing they want is to have a further inflation in the property bubble. Then we can also think about the fact that the Chinex index, which is the technology or smaller companies technology index, continues to trend higher. And it's doing so in really quite a consistent manner, although the pace of the advance is certainly picking up heading into that New Year holiday. Now, we can continue to see that geopolitical tensions are rising, and it is extremely difficult to find an honest analytical opinion of China. There are really two extremes. There are the people that are completely pro-China and will do nothing to upset their relationship with their business interests in China. Then there are those, and particularly the Chinese expat community, who are about as anti-communist as you can possibly find. They continue to highlight the numerous human rights abuses that continue to go on inside the country. The stock market and the bond market and the currency markets are looking past all of those considerations because the currency is appreciating, because China's growth is outperforming, and because they're attempting to encourage foreign investment. And foreign investment in China moved to a level above the USA for the first time in 7 or 8 years at the end of last year. So China is definitely more successful in attracting foreign interest. But it's not like we don't have evidence of really quite speculative activity in China as well. This continued advance in Kuaichao Muotai is really quite spectacular. And there is no question that the trend is accelerating right now. This kind of advance is on par with the kind of move that we've had in Tesla, for example, but also in other stocks like Great Wall. And Great Wall has at least paused over the last few weeks, and it is now at least attempting to find support around this 25 Hong Kong dollar level. When we think, though, about what are China's longer-term ambitions, it's because it's clear they want to become the global hegemon. So that also suggests that there are geopolitical consequences. And the fact that they are now they're better able to attract foreign direct investment than the USA, that their currency is appreciating, that they're coming out of the pandemic in a stronger position, well, that just amps up the geopolitical tensions. The Taiwanese market continues to rally, and it rebounded in here this week. Investors are not in any way willing to give credence to the potential that Taiwan might be invaded by China. Nonetheless, that does represent a potential outcome. Of course, there is, of course, the potential, at least, that Taiwan might vote for closer ties with China, and that, of course, would be a gift for the Communist Party. But the important point here is that Taiwan's stock market would probably lead any real tensions that arise. So it's not likely that China is going to invade Taiwan in the short term, but it is a possibility at some point over the next decade, because China needs a domestic semiconductor industry, and they don't have one. And when we look at at the SMIC stock ticker. Well, the first thing that pops up on Bloomberg is that sanctions apply to this security. So it's not possible for US investors to buy the stock. But China will continue to plow money into that sector because by one way or another, they're going to develop a domestic semiconductor industry, and they're going to spend however much money it takes to achieve that. Taiwan Semiconductor is clearly the world leader, and it pushed on to another new high in here today. Now let's think then and just go all the way back and think about, well, what is this whole question about Bitcoin? Well, Bitcoin is just the first of the cryptocurrencies. We're moving increasingly towards a digital economy. And some people are thinking about this in terms of a great reset. Others are thinking about it in terms of a digital transition. The reality is that China wants to be independent of the dollar. They're going to set up a digital currency. That digital currency will be backed by something. That something could be the purchasing power of approximately a fifth of the global population. That would at least make sense. From everything I've read about the proposition for the Chinese digital currency, it's going to be like a ration book. And that would suggest that there is ample scope for it to be inflated. So one of the strengths of Bitcoin is that it is limited supply. Now, what could it potentially be used for? Well, it could be used for a global transaction network in a more globalized economy. That's, of course, assuming we go down the further globalization route. It could be viewed as a safe haven against the worst proclivities of governments of particularly the Western world to devalue their currencies. So there is that as well. There is also the, I think, much more relevant point that Bitcoin tends to move in a boom and bust cycle, and absolutely nothing has happened to question that conclusion. So it is quite capable of falling 90% and still being in a bull market overall. Now, we're still in a bull market right now, and it has just completed its most recent range. So there is clear scope that we're going to see additional upside and that it can continue to rally. The continued intention of central banks to print and not to stop printing until they have clear evidence of inflation is obviously going to help to increase the value of just about all of these hard assets or anything that is considered to be limited supply. One thing that we are seeing is that the smaller altcoins are turning to outperformance. So Ethereum continues to push on to new high ground. And just this week, really I guess in the last 10 days, we have started to see that some of the altcoins have also started to perform. So we've seen that, for example, Dogecoin, which is a joke, and literally a joke, has done spectacularly well. And that's really an indication of just how feverish activity is. When we then think about IOTA, well, it has more of the promise. That it can deliver a lot of the promises that the cryptocurrency markets are giving. I remain very much of the opinion that Bitcoin is not going to be the be-all and end-all of the crypto revolution, that eventually we are going to see a clear marketable product that solves or makes easier digital transactions around the world. And that is one of the most inefficient markets in the world right now, and there are a lot of people that have their hands out. So if one wanted to make a real argument about cryptocurrencies, it's that it's the same argument that the internet made back in the 90s, that it's about disintermediation. By cutting out numerous middlemen, then there is the potential to both expand the market and to also harvest those margins. So if one wants to make a bullish case, that's pretty much what it is. But we can also think about the fact that cryptocurrencies trade in sequence in just the same way that the precious metals do. So first gold goes, then the bigger gold shares, and then silver go, and then some of the laggards start to perform, so you get the junior gold miners, and today you're starting to see that platinum is starting to outperform as well. And platinum prices are up another $16. This is a clear breakout. It has now completed its base formation. We are back in a new bull market. I do think that this platinum palladium ratio is just one of the best illustrations of an energy transition that we might hope for. So platinum is now back on a clear recovery trajectory. It has demonstrated support in the region of the historic lows relative to palladium, and its discount in terms of price relative to both gold and palladium is going to be unwound. And this has been an incredibly prolonged bear market. There's a simple rationale. The limited supply of palladium is really about nickel. So if we look at the futures price, nickel hasn't gone anywhere for most of the last decade, but it is now starting to recover. And one of the biggest sources of palladium is nickel mining. There's a new demand growth story for nickel, and it's that of batteries. And the newer versions of electric car batteries require more nickel, and it's a purer form of nickel. So that also means that you need to mine more of it. Well, this looks like a bull market overall. We have a clear rounding characteristic over the course of the last 10 years, and it's now pushing back up towards the big psychological 20,000 level. If nickel prices rise, then palladium supply increases. So all of the arguments about the continued supply deficits for palladium become less convincing. Now the price continues to rebound from the region of the trend mean, and so far this is a consolidation. If it were to sustain a move below the trend mean, it would be completing a top formation because we have the acceleration, the type 2 massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and now the period of right-hand extension. It absolutely needs to hold the region of the trend mean in order to be given the benefit of the doubt. Now, then when we think about the overall outlook for the platinum markets, it took this massive dump because of the diesel cheating scandal. We had incredible supply disruption. There were whole mines for platinum closed, and now we have a new demand story in the form of hydrogen. Now, hydrogen is obviously a fairy tale market at the moment because it's not something that we have real evidence to point to and say, well, look, there is a hydrogen station. Those are hydrogen processing plants. Here are the examples of massive supply already underway or massive use cases. But the reality is that a lot of money is being poured into the sector overall. And one of the most important, I think, arguments for why there will be a bull market in hydrogen is because of the potential for energy independence. It's a, I think, forget for a moment the whole question of carbon emissions. I really think that's a red herring. When we look at the kinds of efforts that are being pioneered to develop renewable energy, though the biggest champions of it are the energy consumers. So what this is really about is resource nationalism. Europe and China in particular have seen that the biggest consumer of oil in the world is now a basically an energy independent state, and that is a massive geopolitical advantage. So they are now in a hurry to also become energy independent, and they can't do it with oil because they just don't have it. That means they have to come up with an alternative. So Europe and China are going to pioneer the evolution of new sources of energy, and the more of that that can be produced domestically, the better. So they're going to continue to develop renewable wind and solar. And the big thing that's happened in the last 15 months is that both wind and solar have now achieved the economies of scale and the technology necessary to be completely independent of subsidies. So any industry that suddenly becomes independent of subsidies, well, they get to then go and accuse all of the other businesses that are dependent on subsidies of taking government handouts. And of course, that has been most particularly true of the fossil fuel companies. So oil prices continue to move higher, and there is the potential that we're going to see a recovery in the oil sector. We have had some supply getting shut in. The fate of the offshore drilling companies is just a clear example of that. Seadrill had come out of bankruptcy in 2018, and after a brief flurry of interest, lost 99% of its value and filed for Chapter 11 protection on Wednesday, and is looking for forbearance in here today. Well, if they can survive, and the share was up in, then that is an upside Q reversal this week. If they can break the downtrend, then there's the potential that this could be a rather opportune area to be thinking about taking an option. I guess are taking some optionality on the potential that we are going to have an energy or a fossil fuel recovery. The reality is that we're going to still be using oil forever. We've been trying to get rid of coal from the global economy for 150 years, and it's still growing in terms of demand. So this energy transition is not going to completely do away with oil. But when we think about bear markets end because there's been supply destruction. And oil prices have been in this lengthy period of ranging now for a decade. And there is no money for additional new supply. That's particularly true in terms of the exploration budgets for the majors. So they are not spending money on new supply, and they are just going to produce with the properties they have. So that is going to at least contain supply growth. Then offshore is going to get shut in. If companies like Seadrill are going to survive, well, then they're probably going to have to get a lot better at installing wind turbines, offshore at least, because the profitability of drilling in ultra deep water, for example, is just not there when prices are at $60 or even $80, because you would need to be hedging at approximately $90 in order to be able to fund ultra deep water. And the ability to hedge out beyond 12 months at those kinds of levels is it's just not realizable. So We're still in a bull market environment for the Brent crude price. It's likely to start dragging the energy companies higher, but we would need to see a new demand growth story in order to see prices establishing themselves above $140. And obviously, that's a tall ask at this stage. In other words, we're likely to see occasional spikes past $100. But it's not like there's a shortage of oil. There is plenty of oil out there. The entire bull market from the early 2000s through to 2011-12 was about deploying new sources of supply. The supply response during the bull market for copper was a lot less convincing. So copper prices are a lot closer to taking out their all-time highs, and I think it is much more likely that they will do that. Copper has now got two new sources of demand. So we have transportation and energy generation. So where are the new sources of demand for oil? Well, the only sources of demand at present are for transportation primarily and plastics. Well, plastics are not exactly fashionable at the moment, and there's a lot of competition as a transportation fuel. So what we're looking at instead right now is a trading opportunity, whereas in the copper price, because of these new sources of demand, it has much greater potential to be a secular bull market because it takes years to develop new sources of supply for copper. I think that is one of the most profound changes, that we're in an environment where there is a clear geopolitical imperative to become energy independent, and the ability to do that is much more tied to the evolution of copper than it is to oil. And I think that is just that argument alone is one of the reasons why we're likely to continue to see the renewable energy sector to do well. As we think then about the dollar and an emerging commodity-led bull market, then we can also think about emerging markets overall. And in just the same way that we see this ordering or the successive nature in which the precious metals tend to rally and the cryptocurrencies tend to rally, we're starting to see the same thing in the emerging markets. So we can think about the fact that the MSCI Emerging Market Index has just broken out to a new all-time high. Now, it's been ranging for 13 years. So this is a very significant development. And the major semiconductor producers like Taiwan and South Korea have led the way on the way up. So it is the developed Asian countries have been leading the way higher. The Japanese market and the Nikkei have clearly broken the 25,000 level. It is clearly pushing on the upside, and this is really an explosive breakout. And it is now also breaking out to new all-time highs in US dollar terms. That is both a function of the performance of the stock market and also the weakness of the dollar versus the yen. Then we can think about the performance of the Indian market, where we have this very clear growth agenda. Interest rates have been cut aggressively. Then we can also think about the fact that the fiscal stimulus has really only just been announced. So India has clearly broken on the upside. So these are the leading markets. When we think about the other big population areas in Asia, well, Indonesia has been ranging now for most of the last 3 years. It's been subject to a lot of volatility, but We definitely then also need to consider what the impact of the devaluation of the currency over the course of the last decade had on the performance of the index, because it's really been ranging for a decade, and it's only just beginning to come back up towards the upper side of that range now. So if we think about the ordering in which people are looking at Asia and looking at emerging markets, they've already bought the bonds. The bond yields have already compressed. And that was the, I guess, what many would have considered the lower risk way of participating in the market. So that opportunity has, in many respects, been exhausted because as government bond yields start to rise, then some of that money will flow out of bonds. There won't be quite the same value proposition. But the stock markets are only at the beginning of trying or beginning of breaking out. So we've seen the developed markets move first. We're now seeing the less developed markets beginning to move. Indonesia has been rallying or been going sideways for 11 years in dollar terms. The Malaysian market has been doing very little but decline since 2014 and is really now just breaking up and out of the downtrend and has found support in the region of the trend mean now twice. The Vietnam market is perhaps the most popular of the frontier markets. It got right up to test its all-time peak at the beginning of this month in nominal terms. That was only the peak from back in 2018 in dollar terms. It's now firming from above the trend mean and it remains on a recovery trajectory. Now, when we think about the frontier markets overall, well, they're only just beginning to attract interest. These are generally considered to be smaller markets, so they're much more liquidity focused. They don't generally tend to perform in an outsized fashion until they get significant flow. We haven't seen significant flow into the frontier yet. When we think about Pakistan, it's a frontier market. It's a market that has generally been associated with low standards of governance, but the market is starting to rally. It's risen about 50% in the last year, and this looks like an evolving base formation. When we think about Nigeria, well, it's an energy producer, and it's also the largest population in Africa. It's also been considered to be a very risky place overall, but the stock market is starting to put in a base formation. Now, we haven't got a lot of evidence yet to suggest that people are flooding back into these smaller, illiquid markets. But the one thing we do know is that a small amount of money goes a long way in these frontier markets. So there's, I think if we look at where the long term is leading us, then this is quite similar to the redux of the period immediately after the credit immediately after the pop of the Nasdaq bubble. The Nasdaq is still rising. So the inflation of valuations persists. And the Nasdaq 100 was at another new high in here today. The IPO ETF was at another new high today. So perhaps it is incorrect to say that this is similar to the kind of condition we had in 2002 and 2003, and perhaps it is more similar to what we had in 1998 and 1999, because back then nobody wanted the old industrial companies, nobody wanted the commodity companies, everyone was much more interested in the continued performance of IPOs. The IPOs in this cycle are the SPACs, and the SPAC index was at another new high in here today. we're seeing that the value of IPOs continues to increase. That's quite normal. I think it is before the cycle has ended, we're going to see that the size, number, and value of IPOs and new issues on markets will dwarf that of the 1990s for the simple reason that the value of currency is so much less today. Gold prices have been consolidating now for the last 6 months, but they continue to hold the $1,800 area. With the quantity of money that is being printed, then it is really unlikely that we're going to see a meaningful fall in the gold price. In point of fact, with commodities advancing and with money flowing out of the dollar and into other assets, then gold does well in those situations. The correlations between interest in gold and interest in emerging markets are very clear. On this occasion, gold went first. Emerging markets are now starting to go, but the continued weakness of the dollar and therefore the potential for people to search for safe havens and for better yields is likely to be a clear beneficiary for all emerging markets and then also for the precious metal sector overall. Eventually, we're going to see that the incredible valuations of companies like Tesla or Amazon are going to come under some pressure. Whether that is because they run into the ire of regulators, or whether the cash piles that they've accumulated become the target of broke governments, or whether it is about antitrust, all of these are potential headwinds. And it's a lot harder to grow your revenues when you're a $2 trillion company than when you were a $2 billion company. So there is the clear scope that the performance of small caps is also just an additional indication that the cycle is beginning to change. Now, obviously, we're still in a period of incredible technological innovation, and that's not about to change. As we are still in a very liquid environment, then the appetite for innovation, the quantity of money moving in to support innovative solutions to all manner of potential problems, that's likely to persist. But the reality is that a lot of the technology sector is extremely interest rate sensitive. We are going to get to a point where this continued rise in government bond yields is going to cause a problem. Now, we don't have any evidence of it yet. And eventually, we're going to get to a point where the Federal Reserve will have to intervene to support the market, and most particularly the US government. In that regard, we're similar to the kinds of conditions we had in the early 1970s. So if we're to think about where are we and what's likely in the next decade, well, it's likely that inflation is coming for the simple reason that governments need it and they are now willing to do whatever it takes to achieve it. So when we talk about don't fight the Fed, well, that's exactly what the markets are doing. They are inflating asset prices because of the devaluation of the currency. It's only a matter of time before that starts to show up in inflationary measures. I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.